The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. Tuesday, April 9th, 2024. I am Seth Liebson. Young David, it's good to see you, sir, my producer. Otherwise, it's a little thin around here, staff-wise.
Just us chickens.
602-508-0960 is your barrier to entry. If you'd like to join the conversation, add to it. We have a lot to talk about today, including abortion. But are you aware of this? Reporting from the New York Post, Seattle Public Schools dismantling its gifted and talented program, which administrators argued was oversaturated with white and Asian students in favor of a more, quote, inclusive, equitable, and culturally sensitive program, close quote. The district began phasing out its highly capable cohort schools and classrooms for advanced students in the 2021 school year due to racial inequities, the school district notes. The district website states, quote, what we will replace it with will be more inclusive, equitable, and culturally sensitive. In particular, students who have been historically excluded will now have the same opportunities for services as every other student and get the support and enrichment they need to grow, close quote. The enrichment program currently only allows students who placed in the top 2% on standardized exams to be placed in the highly capable cohort to receive enriched learning. The students would then be sorted into one of three elementary schools, five middle schools, and three high schools. But in 2020, the Seattle School Board voted to terminate the program, that magical year of 2020, after a 2018 survey found that the students in the highly capable cohort were 13% multiracial, 11.8% Asian, 3.7% Hispanic, and just 1.6% Black. Nearly 70% were white. By the way, Seattle is 16% Asian and 65% white. Maybe there's an anti-Asian thing going on. No, of course there is not. Some parents of Black students in the program even argued against ending it. Quote, my request is that you please consider the disservice you would be doing to the minorities that are already in this program, close quote, said one father at the school board meeting to approve the new program in 2020. The program does more for Black children, particularly Black boys, than it does for their peers, he said. But then school board vice president Chandra Hampson shot back, quote, this is a pretty masterful job at tokenizing a really small community of color within the existing cohort, close quote. Over the past few years, though, more and more minority students have joined the ranks of the highly capable cohort, and so it goes. Radical equity based not on quality of person or education or ability, but skin color. It was in that old Kurt Vonnegut story, Harrison Bergeron, I referenced the other day, that we were given the postulation of a handicapper general. The officer assigned under that office was to scramble people's thoughts so that they would not have their wits or be able to remember anything important or think for themselves, and, of course, artificially impose weights and brain implants, not to strengthen the weak, but to weaken the strong. To disfigure and blemish the beautiful, dumb down the smart, and hobble the physically talented. Not to lift people up, but to reduce the highest to the lowest. That short story of Kurt Vonnegut's was first published in 1961. A few excerpts, quote, the year was 2081 and everybody was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and the law, they were equal every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anybody else. And all this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th amendments to the Constitution and to the unceasing vigilance of agents of the United States Handicapper General. Some things about living still weren't quite right, though. April, for instance, still drove people crazy by not being springtime. And it was in that clammy month that the HG men took George and Hazel Bergeron's 14-year-old son, Harrison, away. It was tragic, all right, but George and Hazel couldn't think about it very hard. Hazel had a perfectly average intelligence, which meant she couldn't think about anything except in short bursts. And George, while his intelligence was way above normal, had a little mental handicap radio in his ear. He was required by law to wear it at all times. It was tuned to a government transmitter, and every 20 seconds or so, the transmitter would send out some sharp noise to keep people like George from taking unfair advantage of their brains. George and Hazel were watching television. There were tears on Hazel's cheeks, but she'd forgotten for the moment what they were about. On the television screen were ballerinas. A buzzer sounded in George's head. His thoughts fled in panic, like bandits from a burglar alarm. "That was a real pretty dance, that dance they just did," said Hazel. "Huh?" said George. "That dance, it was nice," said Hazel. "Yep," said George. He tried to think a little bit about the ballerinas. They weren't really very good, no better than anyone else would have been anyway. They were burdened with sash weights and bags of birdshot, and their faces were masked so that no one seeing a free and graceful gesture or a pretty face would feel like something the cat drug in. George was toying with the vague notion that maybe dancers shouldn't be handicapped. But he didn't get very far with that thought before another noise in his ear radio scattered his thoughts. George winced. So did two out of the eight ballerinas. It reminds one just too much of what was written 20 years prior in George Orwell's book, 1984. Quote, "There will be no art, no literature, no science. When we are omnipotent, we shall have no more need of science. There will be no distinction between beauty and ugliness. There will be no curiosity, no enjoyment of the process of life. All competing pleasures will be destroyed. But always, do not forget this, always there will be the intoxication of power, constantly increasing and constantly growing subtler. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. And if you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever." It's from 1984. Let us, I guess I'm saying, not replace common sense with fear. Let us not replace care with paranoia. Let us not replace freedom with authoritarianism. Let us not replace equality with death wishes of others. Let us not replace the class war of Marx with the race war of Hitler. Let us not replace our understanding of who we are, why we were founded, and the natural law understandings of truths and civic responsibility with rewritten history, junk thought, and the triumph of the will. For that is what we're doing. Leo Strauss, Alan Bloom and Harry Jaffa, and Walter Burns' teacher, among others, described perfectly well what was going on, what is going on in Seattle, and what is going on in too many places. He says it is safer to understand the low and light of the high than the high and light of the low. For in doing the latter, one necessarily distorts the high, whereas in doing the former, one does not deprive the low of the freedom to reveal itself fully as what it is. And I worry too much about the model and mode of progressive education today, where it is not freedom that is desired. Freedom to unfurl. Freedom in an individual to reveal themselves for who they are, but rather a very stinted, a very cabined, a very constrained view of the purpose of the student and the purpose of education, to keep things low. To keep things low and to have a leveling force, a leveling wind in the classroom, to keep things low so that no one does any better than anyone else. Because those disparities, those inequalities, if you will, of human condition, those very things that make humans human, the very differences in our brains and in our souls, in our abilities and in our interests, will be leveled so that we will all be wearing the same thing, all be thinking the same thing, all be looking like one another, and all be struggling to achieve the base level of mediocrity. That's where we're headed. I'm Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960, 602-5080-960. National news will be focusing on Arizona over the next couple of days, starting today, given the Arizona State Supreme Court's ruling on abortion here in Arizona. There are a couple different ways the Supreme Court could have decided this case. There were basically conflicting laws and uncertainty as to whether a 2022 law signed by Governor Ducey should obtain, or whether what is known as the older territorial abortion law should obtain, and whether the Ducey piece of legislation overruled it. Those are two. There's a third way as well that the court could have looked at this. We will have Kathy Herod from the Center for Arizona Policy on a little bit later this hour to talk about it. But this is in no – by no means is this the most important aspect of this discussion that I'm about to share with you. But I would like you to know it because I don't think you're going to hear it anywhere else. And I'm grateful to a friend for sending this to me. You will read a lot about the 1864 law, the law that was passed before Arizona was even a state. You will read that this was an abortion law that was passed when slavery was legal and all the rest. I just want to make one historical note. Just changes nothing on the merits, but just so you know. In 1977, bylaws 1977, chapter 142, the legislature enacted a new criminal code here in Arizona. It was in this legislation, 1977, not 1864. It was in this legislation that the abortion law was reenacted. Okay? It was signed by Democratic Governor Wesley Boland. On May 31st, 1977, people can talk 1864 all they want, 1977. The new code had a delayed effective date until October 1st, 1978, so that another legislative session could consider the new code and add other changes and amendments as might be warranted or needed. The legislature did just that during the 1978 session when it enacted Chapter 201. Which made significant additions and amendments to the criminal laws in Arizona. Now hold on to your seats. Governor Babbitt became governor on March 4th, 1978, and he signed Chapter 201 on June 9th, 1978. No change was made in the abortion law, and Governor Babbitt did not ask for one. So this 1864 law, to be sure, but it was reenacted by the state legislature in 77, 78, and it was twice reaffirmed and signed by two Democratic governors, Wesley Boland and Bruce Babbitt. Just so you know. Just so you have the full and complete record of history. As I say, it's not the biggest part of this. It's not perhaps the most important part of it. But it is something you should know about with regard to the history. This isn't as antediluvian as the reporters are trying to make it, though it is probably the strictest law, to be sure, in the country right now. What will happen? Any number of things are being discussed. First of all, it doesn't take immediate effect. So there's some time for a few things to suss out at the lower court levels. And at the state legislature, by the way, which is still in session and can, of course, create and write a new law, perhaps one along the lines of the 2022 law that Governor Ducey signed, which was a 15-week abortion permission with exceptions for medical emergencies. which is seems from the polling we have looked at and the polling I have seen, is where most people generally are on this issue. Now, another interesting contour to all this. Pro-life groups, pro-life organizations and activist and legal institutes are more positive about this decision from the Arizona Supreme Court. They are more, is chary the right word? I believe it is. Are more no, I'm wrong. It's not chary. Chary's the other way. Anyway, they're more they are more positive about this ruling than are Republican candidates. Republican candidates much more chary. That would be the use of the word chary, C-H-R-Y. Much more chary about this. Why? Well, because Republican candidates running for office see the defense of this or their requirement to defend this most strictest of laws in the country as harmful to election efforts, because most people indeed are not for prohibiting abortion with zero exceptions, except for the life of the mother from the moment of conception. We aren't there yet. I have long thought that ever since Roe versus Wade was decided, that given the sweep of the decades since 1973 when it was decided. What are you talking about? 50 years, practically 50 years of unrestricted, constitutionally infused rights to abortion that saw an explosion in the use of the practice of abortion since 1973, cannot have the spigot go from full Niagara Falls to zero overnight. You can't lurch a nation culturally, constitutionally, or legally that fast. I don't know of very many examples of that ever working out. So there has to be a conditioning, a planting of flags along the way, an implanting of changing the law little by little to change the culture little by little. Yes, laws inform culture, but culture informs laws. It's mutually reliant. I believe there's a symbiotic relationship between what changes what, laws, culture, or culture, laws. It goes in both directions. Of course, when it comes to abortion, it is a medical procedure that is overseen by the law. So to change the culture, you have to change the law. To change the law here, you are going to have to do it, I believe, somewhat more incrementally than from going 100 miles an hour to zero overnight. I just don't think the country can do that. And that's why I think we're going to have to talk about some political grounds here at the highest levels, at the Aristotelian levels. And I would love your views on this. 602-508-0960. Should there be a federal ban? Donald Trump said 2 days ago there should not be a federal ban. It should each be left to the states. Should there be a time limit? Should there be exceptions? I'd love to hear your voice on this. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, portions of which are brought to you by our good friends at YRefi that offer a secure investment in a collateralized portfolio where you can turn your income on or off. You can compound it, where there are absolutely no fees, where there is no attack on principal if you ever need your money back. And of course, with YRefi, you get a monthly statement with no surprises. Best of all, you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return with YRefi. And by the way, it's not correlated to the stock market or the Federal Reserve. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then R-E-F-Y.com, or call 888-YREFI-24. Dan is in Phoenix. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Seth. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
Hey, you know what? I think you're right that we have to get to the culture, but it strikes me that the progressives have used education for a long time to impact culture. And what would happen if we literally made it a law that in middle school and high school, students all had to watch a live abortion? I think it would have a huge impact on those students.
Do you want schools and teachers doing that and discussing that? Do you want teachers, if they comply with the law, showing that film, then, of course, talking about it any way they would want to?
I'm just rolling it in my head, trying to figure out how to.
I would rather it not be in schools at all, honestly. And I
get that.
Yeah.
But I think, Seth, tell me if I believe that the students are getting bad information about abortions.
They're getting awful information in a lot of fields and in a lot of areas, including in sex ed. I would get rid of all of it. I would leave this to a discussion between parents and children, parents and their children. I would not want teachers talking about this at all, at all. And I worry, too, about trauma. I worry about visual trauma. It's hard for an adult to see such a thing. I would not want to foist it, honestly, on 11-year-olds or 12-year-olds or even 13-year-olds. They may be, perhaps are in some cases, able to assimilate that. But that would be, I think, an important thing for the parents to do. I am not really crazy generally about the imposition of certain kinds of curriculum on tendentious issues. I'd rather it be removed from the classroom. I have seen mandates on curriculum, even on such things you would think would be beneficial and make all the sense in the world, like Holocaust curricula, stuff like that. I've seen all of that get distorted and warped. I teach history, of course, but let's not mandate controversial subjects in themology, I believe, because with this teaching force, with the profession of educators and where they generally tend to stand on these issues, on these socially, as you put it, progressive issues, it's going to end up ruinous. On top of which, I think I am much more in favor of removing traumatic images and delaying and delaying and delaying them for as long as possible. I think we have to be consistent that if we don't want first and second graders learning about sexuality and the ability to change their sex and to learn about some of the more graphic things adults want them to learn about because it soothes adult anxieties or defends their positions on lifestyle choice, let us say. I think we should be consistent in saying, you know what, too? Let's keep this out of the classroom also. It's not something for 11-year-olds. It's just not. It is something for parents to deal with at the time they think ripe. That's my view. I'm willing to be wrong. But thanks for the call, Dan. Kathy Herod coming up, and then we'll take more of your calls when we come right back. Well, welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. She may be the busiest person in the country today. She describes herself as a wife, mother, attorney. I describe her as a good and longtime friend. She is Kathy Herod, among other things, the president of the Center for Arizona Policy. If anyone knows more about abortion or abortion law in Arizona, they aren't Kathy Herod. Kathy, thanks on this very busy day for joining us today.
Well, thank you, my friend. Glad to be on with you.
Okay, thank you. You're glad. I bet you're glad to have a friendly voice today. I don't know. Let me ask you to break this down any which way you want. I opened the show. I may have been right or wrong. I always will yield to your correction on these things, that the Supreme Court of Arizona could have gone a couple of different ways because there were a couple conflicting laws. Why don't you take it from there and describe to the people what happened?
Sure. Arizona has what we call a pre-Roe law, and this was the law that was in effect on January 22nd, 1973, when Roe v. Wade was handed down. that pre-Roe law said that abortion was not legal unless necessary to save the life of the mother. It had actually been upheld as constitutional by an appellate court in Arizona. Then Roe comes down, and it makes that law not constitutional under the U.S. Constitution. So for the almost 50 years of Roe versus Wade, the statute, it's 13-3603, no abortion except when necessary to save the life of the mother. That was unenforceable. So Roe gets overturned. And so then it becomes an issue of, what's going to happen next? When the Arizona legislature in 2022 passed a law limiting abortions to 15 weeks gestational age. But in that law, they said they did not repeal this 13-3603. So the law was intended, that law was intended to mean that if Roe was still the law of the land, then 15 weeks was the limit on abortion in Arizona. Abortions were only legal up to 15 weeks. But if Roe was overturned, then the 13-3603, the pre-Roe law that had not been repealed, would again be in effect. So today's decision, it's very important to note, was one of statutory construction. It was, as you said, the court deciding, would it be the 15-week limit or would it be the pre-Roe law? And the court today upheld the pre-Roe law as being the one that's how the legislature constructed the law, and that's what would be that's what is constitutional.
Thank you for that.
Not constitutional. I'm sorry. It's not any kind of constitutional decision.
Right. No. Thank you for that, Kathy. Some are arguing. Your take, please, on this. Some are arguing that the 2022 law was intended to be the most current law, regardless of the fact that we had this lagging or Regnant 1864 law hanging out there?
Well, at the time, I will say we never hid the fact. Former State Senator Nancy Bartow was the sponsor. We made it as clear as we could that I well remember. It was always very clear that if Roe was overturned, it would be the pre-Roe law, not the 15-week limit. So those who now are saying that they thought it would only be the 15-week limit, well, clearly in that law, if you go back and look, it was Senate Bill 1164 that year. It said that 13-3603 is not repealed.
Understood.
Either by implied or otherwise, by implication or otherwise. And the court, for those who like to read court opinions, Justice Lopez did a masterful job of rebutting every argument made by Planned Parenthood, that being one of them.
Fair enough, Kathy. Thank you for that. And I guess the thought then was the 2022 law would comply with or be held, theoretically could have been held constitutional under Roe if Roe were not overturned. Is that what the thinking was at the time, that it might pass constitutional muster?
Well, the thinking was that Mississippi had passed their law, the 15-week limit on abortion. That law was designed to a large extent to challenge Roe versus Wade,
yeah.
But no one knew whether the court would would do that or not.
Right.
And so it was, if the court says it's only 15 weeks in Mississippi, then at least Arizona would be protecting human life and women, unborn babies and women up until past 15 weeks. We also know that at that time, only about 636 abortions happened after 15 weeks. So that's only about 5% of all abortions that happen in our state, roughly, if my math is right.
Yeah.
So there was never any question what the law's intent was. But now, because we're in a political year, some are having second thoughts about what happened back in 2022.
If they go with those second thoughts, Kathy, if, I'm not saying should, but if they go with those second thoughts, can the state legislature now, presently, or in the next several weeks, rewrite the law so that the 1864 law is not the applicable law, but something closer to the 2022 law would be? Is that on the table as a possibility?
Yes. Now, Seth, I never called the 1864 law because it was the pre-Roe law that was in effect January 22nd, 1973. So
Fair enough.
Yeah. Yep. But the Arizona legislature could repeal that law by a majority vote and Governor Hobbs signing it. Governor Hobbs today called on the legislature to repeal the law. Other politicians have been calling on the legislature to repeal that law. That is a policy decision that the court left to the legislators. To do that, they have to have 31 in the House, 16 in the Senate, as we know. So if the legislature were to repeal the pre-Roe law, then that would leave in place the 15-week limit.
Okay. Gotcha. By the way, that correction you gave, I'm glad that you did. I was doing one on myself and on that very point. It's been the history is kind of interesting that when our criminal code was being rewritten, including this law that we're talking about right now, it was signed off by two Democratic governors in 1978 and 1979 by Bruce Babbitt and by Wesley Boland. So, I mean, the idea that it was goes all the way back to 1864 is itself a little bit of a historical revision. It really goes back to the re-signing by Governor Babbitt in 1978.
Exactly. So even when I say pre-row,
right.
It is also
pre and post-row. Yeah. Right.
And yeah. And the other thing, and that's where, and in the Arizona legislature for many years, there were bills introduced, there were amendments that were filed to repeal this law, and it never happened. The other thing that was interesting in the court decision pointed out another Arizona law that basically says that Arizona laws are to be interpreted in a way that grants unborn children all the privileges, mm-hmm. rights, and immunities of the law mm-hmm. within the constitutional precepts. So that, so they acknowledge that as well. So that the legislature has had a clear design on our laws that we interpret them in favorably for the unborn child, and they didn't repeal the pre-roll law. Now, the other thing to note, though, is that the court clearly said this decision, in our view, this decision is not enforceable for about 60 days.
Yep.
The court specifically gave the proponents in Planned Parenthood 14 days to file a constitutional challenge because, again, as we said before, this did not go into whether the state constitution is silent on abortion or has anything on abortion in it. So in 14 days, we could see Planned Parenthood file a constitutional challenge that blocks the law from getting enforced potentially.
Yep.
We could see the legislature do something.
Yep.
So everything's, there's a lot ahead.
There's a lot in flux right now. And in the meantime, there's probably going to be a referendum on the ballot for people to vote on. I recommend on this show people go to the website. It goes too far. com. Kathy Herod, on this very busy day, it means a ton that you would share some of your time with our audience. Thank you.
Of course. Anytime.
You gotcha. You got it. Thank you. Kathy Herod, Center for Arizona Policy. I'm Seth Leibson. Your call's next. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. 602-508-0960. This is probably going to prove and probably is one of the most difficult issues in the country, not because it's necessarily morally difficult, though maybe for some it is, but because it is so politicized with such stakes. And that is the abortion decision that came down from the Arizona Supreme Court today, which is making national news. I'd love to take your calls on it and air out and ventilate all sides of it. Ann and Chandler, thank you for your patience.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I was very happy to hear about this Supreme Court ruling here in Arizona. And I also think about the statement that Donald Trump made today that he was not interested in a federal law on abortion, but to leave it to the states. And I thought it would have been smart of Carrie Lake to have talked about abortion in that way when she was running and said, this is my personal view, but I will follow the Arizona laws. So I was,
I thought she did say that during the campaign. I thought she did say that during the campaign, that she would support the law.
I don't know, but I've talked to
people. That's my understanding. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
But a lot of people didn't understand that, and I talked to people in my position as a precinct committeeman, and sometimes I would talk to people that I didn't know,
mm-hmm.
I'm in
sure.
a store or something,
sure.
And this one lady said, I would vote, I am a Republican, but I don't agree with Carrie Lake on abortion.
And what was the disagreement?
And her position was that Carrie Lake was too hard on abortion, and I didn't get into the specifics, but,
too much on the pro-life side. Okay.
Right.
Well, I mean, you have a few conflicts here working at the same time, and they are honeycombed. You can say leave it to the states. That is an argument. But if you are going to, say, leave it to the states, then what if the state passes a very restrictive bill or a very pro-life bill, depending on how you want to pitch it? Are you going to oppose the Republican candidate for supporting that? That is one of the difficulties here. Some people are still arguing, and I think morally, on morally firm ground, for a federal piece of legislation on this. I think it's a very hard thing for someone to say, I have a very strong moral problem with abortion, but whatever the majority decides is fine. I think that's a very difficult place to be. Happy to take more of your calls. 602-508-0960.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.